This episode of AVXL is recorded on January 18th, 2018. We're going to talk CES 2018, at least part one. New TVs from LG, Samsung, TCL, Hisense, and Sony. Why LED might catch up with OLED soon. Flagship AVRs from Denon & Marantz. Projection screens. Speakers from Elac, DeVore, and Definitive. Smart appliances. Google Assistant, Alexa, Bixby, turntables. And so much more.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Open AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater and audio gear, no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Norton.
Oh, yeah. Hey, it's Robert.
I have not vomited from coughing in at least 40 hours.
This is cut.
Oh, my goodness.
The plague?
I caught the CES plague. I went down for like 13 hours on Thursday night and then talked to everyone I needed to talk to on Friday from a distance.
The post-CES plague.
I'd like to thank Definitive and Elac and Audio-Technica and Biodynamic and several other AudioQuest, several other groups I talked to in the Venetian.
Your plague day?
On Friday for not being offended when I touched elbows with them and kept my distance.
Oh, no. That's the move. You either fist bump or elbow bump.
Yeah, I wasn't getting my fist near anybody.
Man, people need to wash their hands more. That's all I have to say.
Oh, my goodness.
I will say, I think the flu shots are working. My past method of dealing with CES was to simply get as dirty as possible and just absorb the disease and let my body have
everybody thinks
that natural response.
Because, you know, Robert would be like, somebody would be like, what are you going to do at CES? And Robert would be like, lick doorknobs. No. You know?
The old-fashioned way of resistance.
You know. It's...
However, on my second year now of doing flu shots ever, I'm feeling pretty good. I was sick for like 6 hours before I went to CES. Mm-hmm. And just like a roommate got a really bad flu bug. And I had that for like, it felt like half a day.
Yeah.
So, and then while I was at the show, there were people dropping left and right. And I think the key is hydration. And I will say one of my favorite pieces of tech on the show floor at CES were those terrific bottle refilling stations that were combined with a water fountain.
I started looking for those when you mentioned them and never saw a single one.
They were scattered. But as soon as I saw one, then mm-hmm. suddenly I was like seeing them all. It was like, man, you get that first glimpse of one. And I will say, you can't drink just water at a trade show like that. You have to mix it up with some electrolytes and whatever your choice is. But plain water after a while just doesn't seem to cut it. So there's my one pro CES tip. Bring a good battery pack and cut your water with 50% Gatorade.
I'm a big fan of, you know, I'm not generally into sugary beverages that claim to have health impacts, but no. I will say Vitamin Waters Revive kept my wife alive.
The purple one?
She was having dehydration issues when she was pregnant with our oldest. So I have assigned like mythical belief in that. And that was like, I crawled home with two bottles of that on Thursday night, drank one before falling asleep, and drank the second one when I woke up at 3 a.m. before I passed out again. But this technically is a podcast,
yes.
Not about...
illness.
Surviving
survival
large
technique.
Trade shows full of vile sickness, but about home theater and audio. And we should probably start with the thing people ask us about the most, which oddly enough is not surround sound speakers and is actually televisions, probably because people think about one a little bit more than the other in this transitional time as we leave the 1080 and move towards the 4K HDR. And big questions going into
there.
This. Can LG top last year's OLED? Will LED, aka Samsung, ever catch up to the image quality, or I should say the color quality, of LG's OLED? Can TCL have another out-of-the-ballpark hit like they did with last year's P5 Series 55-inch 4K HDR, which was like the affordable monitor of choice for everybody on the planet? And then it turns out Hisense is back, and of course Sony is being Sony and doing something so crazy it completely redefined Robert's concept of HDR, and he's been... You've been like a homeless guy. You've either been shouting about it or muttering about it for like a week, which is, you know.
I just love those Sony demos. The answer to all of your questions is yes. I will just say right there, the short story to everything you just said, yes. LG is doing up their 8 series panels as the successor to the 7 series for last year. As far as panel performance goes, I think you'll see very incremental improvements mm-hmm. in terms of like color space performance. Absolute brightness, I don't think is going to change a hell of a lot
right.
compared to the 7 series. The big deal there will be some new calibration features built into the TV, I think is the big one, at least on my view of it. Mm-hmm. Specifically, we'll have direct access to what they call a television's lookup tables, both for grayscale and color calibration. This means that rather than, say, using an external box to perfect the image quality with many more points of adjustability compared to the internal controls on the TV, this will allow you to directly access the tables within the TV itself with appropriate software that will allow you then to do very detailed calibrations that should put these displays on pro-level output, mm-hmm. if it is so desired. This is in partnership with Portrait Displays and their Calman software. And the demonstrations I had a chance to participate in, it looked and performed excellent, even in its current state, not quite ready, but pretty damn close. We were able to go into one of the LG 8 series TVs with the software and the meter right on the screen. A couple button clicks later, and it is auto, quote unquote, auto calibrating for any of the TV's presets independently. And that was everything from its expert modes, cinema modes, all the HDR modes, and I think more importantly, perhaps for a lot of people, would be the gaming modes that have been a challenge to calibrate well due to when you're in game mode and what those source devices are and things like that. So design-wise, everything's about the same still. They aren't bringing the G-Series to the U.S. this year, but I did snap a picture of one on the show floor. That would be the one, if you think about the 7 Series last year, that was with the folding, and the previous year, that was the picture-on-glass design that had the folding soundbar that, if you wall-mounted it, it could tuck under. This year, they're gonna take a pause on that one for the U.S. market, but it is still out there, and it looked interesting. Used the similar ribbon cable, actually, that the beautiful W series, the wallpaper model, uses in terms of having just that single cable go into the panel. Beyond that, there were a couple of also prototype things being shown off by LG as well. And I believe we mentioned these. They had a prototype 8K OLED, nice, large, big display. I think it was mostly to show that they can do this resolution and they can scale up the size beyond maybe 77 inches. We'll see. And of course, I think the thing that got people most excited, at least in terms of people who either got a look at it in person or saw it on the many videos online, was LG's prototype 65-inch roll-up OLED. It is a plastic substrate on the back of this TV that is flexible enough to be able to coil itself up into a box not much larger than, a large soundbar. The beautiful thing about that, one, hey, it can get out of the way when you don't need it, and two, it had a variable system for the screen height, so it didn't have to fully extend out the entire height of a 65-inch TV. You could put it up just enough to do a
21:9.
Exactly. A widescreen view for a movie, or an even more retracted mode where it literally just showed information. So if you wanted to have it stream like time and weather and other things like that, it was fully configurable. The other demo I saw that was actually pretty damn impressive, and this will be applied to many of LG's TVs this year, is the addition of Google Assistant. And every demo I saw with that seemed to work really well.
Yeah, Google spent a staggering amount. So Google's been playing catch up with Alexa.
Oh yeah,
from Amazon. And you know, Shannon and I on Tech Thing have been talking in the last few months how they've really caught up. Given that they were a year behind, they've pretty much caught up.
I think the functionality's there.
Yeah.
And now it's like, can you get the market traction to actually get those devices into people's hands. So.
And they spent, I mean, you couldn't swing a dead cat. You couldn't turn around without seeing a Google Assistant ad, whether it was plastered across the front of the LVCC on the fashion show on cars. Fashion show's a mall right on the strip.
They had a 30-foot-tall gumball machine out front.
Yeah.
For Google Assistant.
And that was one of the more sedate, that was one of the smaller displays. It was in every booth. Now, certainly, Alexa was mentioned, usually in the second breath. Like I think Google paid to make sure they were mentioned first, especially on press day. You know, and then of course there was Samsung, you know, who's trying to keep Bixby alive. I don't want to talk about that because it just seems like a foolish endeavor.
I hear you.
But you know, Google Assistant was talked about constantly. Alexa was talked about in the second breath. HomeKit, I saw pretty much nowhere except for the Wemo crew, who had a HomeKit adapter for their system that sold out in like 4 hours when they put it up on their website. So there's certainly HomeKit users out there, but I don't think they have anything like the mindshare of Amazon or Google.
Every TV manufacturer is adding the term AI to their TV, and not just with Google Assistant. They're all incorporating their own flavor of AI into it to do either internal controls. So when you're not using, say, Google Assistant to do things, you can then use their system. And I think they're piggybacking on Google Assistant in terms of getting themselves up to speed. At least start with something that integrates Google Assistant that you know has a pretty solid foundation of being able to retrieve right. information and data for the user. These companies will then be bringing in their AI for more, hopefully, than just voice recognition and commands like that. It's going to be unlikely that it'll be for actually real-time processing on the video side of it, at least as far as Google Assistant goes built into TVs like LG's 2018 lineup. It just performed the way I would expect it to. When I jumped over to Sony's booth, though, one of the nice things about their booth is they always, every year now for the last few years, they've had a terrific high-end demo, like a futuristic-looking demo. And this year was no exception, and in their booth was their 10,000-nit demo of an 8K display.
Mm-hmm.
And that is 10,000 nits, ta-da, is the actual spec for HDR video as it currently exists. The beautiful thing about this, and this was also highlighting their X1 Ultimate prototype processor that was actually capable of upscaling content to 8K resolution in addition to driving this prototype display with its beautiful DCI color and that amazing 10,000 nits of light output. The beauty there really is that if you consider the content on ultra high def Blu-ray disc, it is authored to whatever the studio decided to author that in terms of its brightness detail within the content. It could be 4,000, it could be up to 10,000 nits. That's actually detailed within the video signal. This TV, with its capability of going up to 10,000 nits, doesn't need to do any of that stuff we call tone mapping, where it is taking that video signal and the characteristics described within it, and then mapping that to the performance of a TV that can't quite make that spec fully. That's what every other TV is currently doing, and it was interesting to see a prototype where it was like, well, okay, you're going to put an 8,000 nit highlight on this particular scene? Well, fine, the TV just does it. Now, when this thing went to pure black, it was obviously not the best black level I've ever seen in the world, but the peak brightness on a full screen image was the most realistic thing I'd seen in a while, particularly with outdoor nature scenes, anything with natural sunlight. It wasn't too bright, and I was standing, I'd say, 3 feet away from it, so it took up my full field of vision, and that was pretty damn fantastic. Samsung is getting into a habit now of not actually introducing really any new TVs for the right. mass market at CES. In this case, though, they did introduce the Q9S. This will be one of their ultra-premium 85-inch displays, pumping out 4,000 nits, and they're claiming 10,000 zones of local dimming. This display looks freaking fantastic. And this is, I guess you could say, the other display they announced was the Wall, their video tiling system that uses emissive LEDs, micro-LEDs on a cube structure, basically, that you can tile together. And they're initially going for 146-inch display size.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, there's no reason you can't scale that up even further. I believe this is based upon their cinema LED technology that they're using in commercial systems. Not the same. It is definitely something else, but very similar to that. Having emissive micro LEDs as a display is about as close as you're going to get to OLED in terms of absolute picture performance. When the pixels turn off, they're absolutely black. And because they're inorganic LEDs, they can dump out some pretty bright light. That was an impressive looking display. When it comes down to the zone measurements, like in the case of the Q9S, they're talking 10,000 zones. I know it's a lot of reviewers out there will use a moving white box on a screen and then just visually kind of see how the backlight system responds, say on a full array local dimming system, where the LEDs on the behind the screen can be individually modulated to help improve contrast in the dark scenes and still pump out a lot of light. In terms of how you would actually go about accurately measuring the number of individual zones as a reviewer, I call into question some of the techniques people are using. I think the box sizes now are just too big. And I'll be curious to see how the manufacturers themselves are actually coming up with these numbers, because I've never seen any reviewer claim that any TV has, say, more than 100 zones. I mean, in terms of what they could actually measure. Realistically, how many zones are there? Or how do the manufacturers come up with the numbers they do? However, behind closed doors, Samsung showed off some prototype displays of their upcoming 2018 lineup. And I will just say straight up, We were comparing these directly to competitor models, right? Within the room and the demonstration material being shown was identical on all the TVs. They appeared to be similarly set up. Samsung has some LCD tech coming up that is as good as anything I've seen, be it OLED, LCD, plasma, whatever.
Now, they're not giving you, they're not saying it will be out in this particular time frame. They basically, this was a...
This will be
hey, kid, the you 2018. Think OLED is good? Yeah, yeah. About 2017 and us not getting any awards. Come here. Let me show you what's coming. I mean, I feel like I Samsung was pissed.
I think after last year where their premium products were at a price at or above what you could get really good OLED for, everyone tended to shift toward the OLED screens en masse. So I will say for at least the demo I've seen, and we'll know in a couple more months when they actually do the official release on their 2018 lineup, the ability to control not only the backlight system, but to deal with off-axis issues like when you get blooming or halos around objects on a black background, as well as just straight up off-axis viewing. It was very difficult to differentiate between what Samsung's doing with an LCD compared to even the best OLEDs. Mm-hmm. It was fantastic looking. And because of the additional light output you could get out of an LCD, of course, compared to an OLED, there may be some significant advantages going down that route. Samsung's always had pretty damn good color in their Q series and their QLED series TVs. I have no doubt that's going to continue. They're doing very well in terms of color rendering for 2017 and going into 2018. So that I am looking forward to seeing in person. Over at the Hisense booth, I got to tell you, that H10e, that's their flagship. They're claiming 1,000 zones of full array local dimming, 2,000 nits. That was one of the single most impressive TVs I saw on the show floor as far as LCDs go. That really just, again, they're doing so much better with off-axis in addition to being able to control those blooming and halo artifacts that are associated with LCDs doing very bright imagery on, say, dark backgrounds and things like that. They also had a H9 Plus, too, that I believe was edge-lit, and that was nearly as good as that H10e. So those are two TVs I am really looking forward to. They were also showing off their 4K laser short throw projectors as well with integrated Harman Kardon audio. The one I'm
that,
most...
I gotta say that soundbar looked really good at the base of that. On the C, it was the C series, right?
For which one?
The integrated Harman Kardon soundbar.
Oh, this was just built right into the projector itself.
Oh, sorry. I'm confusing it. I was thinking of the TCL televisions.
It's okay.
Did I mention the sickness and the flu and the fever and the vomiting children?
Hisense's laser televisions are effectively integrating audio, and they'll have wireless external subs for additional performance there. They're offering a larger size for this year, 150-inch, at about $10,000, which sounds expensive until you try to price out, say, the 146-inch Samsung The Wall. It might seem like a total bargain. But still, what I am really waiting for from them is their dual-color laser, where it uses red and blue lasers to effectively achieve over 95% DCI color with 4K resolution. That's the projector I really want to see out of them. And I am still awaiting a time frame for that. I'm really hoping they can get that out before the end of this year. But that was also on the show floor. They also, in their booth, had a live demo of ATSC 3 running. Granted, it was canned. The transmitter was like literally 5 feet away from the TV. But they were demonstrating it with an actual antenna into a running TV. And they even had a mobile device right nearby that was able to receive the same signaling and to provide full HDR 4K resolution over a broadcast signal. So still, we're awaiting TVs and technology to implement, and the broadcasters to implement ATSC 3. That, I think, will start to trickle out this year, but I doubt we'll see any TVs with integrated ATSC 3 tuners this year. That, I think, is going to be the big 2019 thing. Who else? Oh, one quick one, too. I mean, well, TCL, of course. That P607 that impressed everyone so much last year, that is now being supplanted or upgraded to the just straight up 6 series. Effectively, very similar technology to last year. Dolby Vision decoding built in, 120 zones of local dimming. New for this year would be just design wise.
Sure.
They look more premium than they have in the past. Brushed metal frames, good looking trim. And of course, Roku TV built in, including the latest version 8 of their software that incorporates cool features. Specifically, if you're an over-the-air tuner aficionado, there are now 14-day channel guides built in addition to just some really clever updates in terms of finding content in a variety of sources, be it streaming or broadcast or however. I really felt that their approach to it was similar to what we think of in terms of canistream.it for finding a particular show or content and where you can get that from. They're literally integrating something very similar to that in the TV.
That's cool.
Better still, I appreciated the Roku TV guys mentioning that pretty much every Roku TV from 2014 on will receive this 8.0 software update. So that to me was fantastic, man. And if I have to keep on the over-the-air goodness for just a second, the good folks over at Channel Master were showing off something called the Smartena Plus. And it looks, for all intents and purposes, it looks like a standard flat antenna design you'd use for your indoor use. The cool thing about this is it does require its own power supply, but it integrates a 7 antenna configuration within this flat antenna design. So with the press of a button on the antenna itself, it will go through all 7 of those internal configurations for the antenna layout, pick the one that gives you the most channels, and boom. Ideally, this will allow you then to place that antenna where you want to, let the antenna figure out its best internal configuration for where you want to put that antenna, and go from there. It's available for pre-order right now. It looks like it's $90, and I'm getting mine in there ASAP. One other interesting observation I had on the show floor was that how many companies are using LG's OLEDs. There were several Chinese manufacturers on the floor showing off their designs they would love to bring into the United States, but it's such a competitive market
here. It reminds me of the SEMA show, where the first time I went to SEMA, which is the car automotive equivalent CES, where I walked across the entire downstairs of the Sands, and each booth was like 50 yards long, and these huge booths with these insane tires. And it occurred to me, and I walked all the way back and walked over again, that I'd passed like 13 car tire manufacturers and some of the biggest booths I'd ever seen in Las Vegas, none of which I had ever heard of. And they were all from, like, you know, Uzbekistan and China and India, and all they wanted to do is get like 0.0% of the U.S. tire market.
Yep.
Those booths with the OLED screens from Chinese manufacturers we'd never heard of all seem like those tire vendors. Like, they just want to get a little tiny toe. They want to be the next TCL, I think.
It was staggering, though. You name it, be it a wallpaper design or a standard OLED-looking TV. I only saw LG OLEDs on the show floor. And there were many, many companies making it. And if that's a sign of what's coming to the Chinese market, well, there's going to be no shortage of OLED options. Now, just off of the show floor, barely, over at the Westgate Hotel, there were many vendors. Optoma was showing off their new 4K Amazon Alexa-enabled projector, which had some interesting custom stuff related to that in terms of being able to have it also trigger like a motorized screen or other features within a room if you had it tied up that way, in terms of being able to like dim the lights and get the picture rolling, as well as as you could imagine, just being able to search for content and other things like that. Great pricing as well. Over in the LG booth, I had a great chance to get some eyeball time on their new 4K projector. It wasn't the best place to actually check out the picture quality. There were probably about 8 projectors in this tiny little room that was way too hot. The LG HU80KA. This thing almost has a bit of an industrial design. It looks about the size of a big loaf of bread. Very boxy. Carrying handle, which also doubles as a mount bracket. Lamp-based, so you're not dealing with laser yet. One of the neat things about it was its flexibility in terms of being able to set it up. Mm-hmm. Now, it has what could affectionately be called a lens cover on the top, but this also doubles as a mirror, so if you stand it upright, it can be a short throw design. If you retract that mirror top completely, you can then point it straight forward like a normal projector, or point it up, or mount it on the ceiling and shoot it down. Just a terrific minimalist design, but it also incorporates all of my favorite things, including, you know, HDMI, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, apps built in. The big deal for me really was I really appreciated the incorporation of ATSC tuners into their previous smart projectors, and I'm really hoping this one carries it over. That was the one feature I didn't see an antenna connection on the projector itself, but for a projector this portable and handy, it's nice just to have that tuner built in, especially if you live somewhere you can take advantage of digital over-the-air HD reception. We were talking about the new Visa spec for HDR monitor performance, and basically they have one that starts off with, well, there is no minimum light output for this. It's just HDR compatible. Compatible with the signaling, but you're still dealing with like Rec. 709 color. When you get up into the 600 and above, you're not only increasing the light output to at least that 600 nit level or 1000 nit level in the case of the 1000 nit spec, but you're also getting that DCI color performance, which it's more realistic and lifelike. And for pro-ish monitors, for sure, these were just fantastic looking. They had one, their curved monitor they were using as a gaming demo, while the flat screen 4K monitor was more for, I'd say, authoring content and other things like that. But it was just a beautiful design, punchy looking display, especially with the light and the color output. Oh yeah, one other quick thing over in the Westgate Hotel was our good friends over at Nanosys showing off some of the latest in quantum dot technology. Mm-hmm. They now had an RGB demo of a quantum emissive display, or electro-emissive, excuse me.
Really?
Where they had materials being stimulated by electrons that would then emit light in either red, blue, or green. So that'll be the future in a few years. What's happening this year is that the materials that were normally in a separate diffuser layer sheet, typically they use in LED TVs that are using quantum dots, they'll use a blue backlight or a blue LED backlight system, mm-hmm. and then run that blue light through a diffuser layer in the LCD stack that contains the red and the green quantum dot materials.
Interesting.
The new step will be to move those quantum dot materials out of that separate diffuser layer sheet directly into the color filter itself, so that the red subpixels and the green subpixels will actually contain the quantum dot materials. The quote-unquote blue subpixel would simply be mostly clear to allow the blue light of the backlighting system to come through. This gets two-thirds of those subpixels effectively emanating light right at the surface of the screen. So that might be one way you're going to see a lot of manufacturers going for improved off-axis viewing, efficiency improvements in terms of either more light output for the same given power budget, and the next evolution of this technology towards a fully emissive quantum dot display, which we probably won't see for a couple more years, but at least in terms of consumer products. That was a fantastic demo, and they were also highlighting some of the new tricks LCD manufacturers are going to be using in terms of making even thinner, brighter displays, of course, with quantum dot materials. So
with quantum dot awesomeness.
Quantum dot awesomeness!
Oh my goodness. Well, while we're talking about the Westgate, Riva Audio had come out with some pretty fantastic Bluetooth speakers, and we kind of lost touch with them as they launched the new Festival and Arena, which are essentially their Sonos competitors. And they had the new Riva Central at CES 2018, which is essentially a stereo, two-channel, 55 watts per channel, and a 4 ohms Class D amp box that allows you to attach your speakers of choice or patch those into Riva's home audio system.
Very nice.
So it joins the Festival and the Arena, and now there's the Central. I don't have the pricing for that off the top of my head. It's coming soon. You can't order it yet. I love the fact there's a subwoofer out built into it. They've got like a selectable preamp, which I think means basically you can choose to use their preamp or not. But the subwoofer out is awesome. The build quality felt really, really good based on the model. I got my grubby little paws on it. They're sweet. There's controls on the front for play and pause and volume and fast forward and backwards skipping, if you will, which is a big deal to me because I love having controls on devices. I think about that every time I don't have the remote in my hand and there's a power switch and a play button on the Bluetooth, or excuse me, on the Blu-ray player I have.
Nice.
But Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, AirPlay, DLNA, Chromecast built in, and it'll work with Spotify Connect. It's good to see those guys again. And it sounds like they have some really cool stuff up their sleeves, which they basically hyped up and teased us about, but did not reveal anything about. So that was highly amusing. One of the first things I saw at CES this year was from MyTech Digital, and they make the highly regarded Brooklyn DAC Plus and DAC 2 and the Brooklyn Amp. They all sound great, but the design, like I want to put them in my lap and pet them like a cat. They have these beautiful sort of hammered looking faces. It's just one of those points where somebody did some really sweet design onto what it's basically like. There's not a lot you can do with the DAC. It's a box.
Right.
It's a USB thing. But it's a USB box.
It caught your eye though.
Yeah, and I've been admiring these ever since the first time I saw one at CanJam a couple years ago. Their DAC Plus, which is also a headphone amplifier, is like $2,200. The DAC 2 is $6,000. Oh, okay. These are not inexpensive devices. But they came
audiophile
out with the clef. So, which is a Bluetooth portable battery powered, they call it a battery powered hi-fi system. So essentially it's an external Bluetooth headphone amp.
Nice.
Or, you know, as I should say, Bluetooth DAC and amp. And what's kind of crazy is they're doing like up to 32 bits, 384 kilohertz PCM, DSD128. And they claim there's like 120 dB of dynamic range, which is...
It's got the chops.
You know, should have enough power to hammer even your most power-hungry planar magnetic headphones.
Cool.
Sounded great, but admittedly, I was, you know, in the middle of a show floor. You know, in a giant ballroom filled with vendors that were packing up. But it was cool to talk to those guys and to see what they're working on. And I love the idea that they're doing something for $300, which is way more approachable.
I was just going to ask what the price was.
$2,200. And I got to say, I was thinking about that and about AudioQuest's Beetle, which they had debuted a couple years ago. Then it kind of disappeared. And apparently it was redone by Gordon Rankin, who does the Dragonflies, who's kind of a genius.
Yeah, don't believe I've heard of the Beetle.
DAC/headphone. Well, it's a Bluetooth adapter for your stereo, right?
So, gotcha.
You know, if you want to send audio to your swank stereo, it's a nice way to do it. I listened to some Tidal lossless stuff over this. It sounded fantastic on their system. I think one of the first things you and I saw together on the show floor was over by the Tech Thing booth, the Tech Thing media box. Denon was showing off the world's first 13.2 channel receiver, the AFR X8500H.
God, that looked nice.
Yeah, it's pretty. You know what was even prettier? The preamp, Marantz preamp version that was in the Definitive / Sound United studio / Marantz, I shouldn't say studio, I should say suite, up in the Venetian. Ooh. Where I heard the full top of the line surround sound experience from Definitive.
But this was ideal, though, that Denon amp, if you wanted one box without dealing with external amplifiers to drive many speakers in a room.
Yeah, literally, like, so they're claiming the world's first 13.2 channel receiver, Atmos up to 7.1.6 or 9.1.4, TTSX, RO3D up to, quote, 13.1. They have 192 kilohertz, 32-bit digital analog converters for all channels, they said. Odyssey Multi-EQ, XT32 for room tuning with all of the trimmings.
One of the nice things I appreciated about, granted, these are not cheap receivers. These are going to be premium products.
It's about $4,000.
However, that and Denon's Next Step Down, I believe, they claimed that both of these, for anyone who buys them, will be receiving upgrades that will enable HDMI 2.1 support. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if you bought it today,
right,
and it has that HDMI 2.0b or whatever is built into it, that works just fine with today's content. You're like, look, I know, and maybe by the end of the year, we're going to have display devices and source devices that can actually support and need the bandwidth required in HDMI 2.1, or even maybe for things like EARC, which we can talk about in a minute. They're offering a free upgrade path for that, for people who are going to go with their premium products for this year. So I just thought that was a nice touch. It was just something where I was like, you know what? I'd feel more confident buying something or spending this kind of money right now on a receiver that could just do it all.
For that, it's nice.
I was thankful.
It was. I mean, it's thoughtful that they were specifically making it clear that they were going to have a module for this, because, you know, 13.1 channels, $4,000, 13 power amps. They said it was rated at 150 watts per channel, although that's a 2-channel drive rating for the highest spec. I'll be curious to see what it does. I'm sure Audioholics will get one and light up all 13 channels simultaneously.
Tell me its weaknesses.
Oh, my goodness. But yeah, and also works with Amazon Alexa and Heos. ELAC was displaying the long-rumored Argo series of powered speakers, which are kind of like cousins to the Unify speakers.
Oh, cool.
But these are 250-watt Class D analog amplification built in. They're going to do sort of a bookshelf / studio monitor version and floor-standing version. So the idea is that, you know, you either connect them to your computer or your preamp, and the power, all basically more power than you need is built in, or you can buy the Discovery Connect wireless transmitter and use that to wirelessly transmit to them. Mr. Jones was adamant about not putting wireless cruft inside of his speaker.
Understood.
Look at about $2,000 for a pair, which puts them on par price-wise with Kef's LS50. They also were showing off the new Alchemy series of preamps and amps. They had sort of a digital streaming / DAC version and one with a phono preamp built into it. You know, unlike Audio Alchemy's design, these were sort of flat, black, stackable, super clean. I mean, the Audio Alchemy stuff is super clean, but it's the usual excellence from Audio Alchemy's Peter Madnick. I mentioned Marantz a second ago.
I got to hear for the second time. The first time was at Cedia, but I got to hear Definitive Technologies Demand Series, the D11 bookshelf speakers. And I got to say, you know, I haven't heard the 7 and the 9-inch version, but the 9-inch and the 11-inch version, the D11 and the D9, they both have upward-firing base radiators, and the D11 sounded fantastic.
I think
you're looking at about a retail or an MSRP of about $1,000 on those. Some really precise imaging, some really gorgeous detail.
I like that. I like that, using the venting the base out the top. That just sounds like a good idea.
Pumping more base out the top, putting a passive radiator, right? I met with SanDisk and Western Digital. I bring this up because they've got a new 256 gigabyte SanDisk UltraFit drive, which is that super tiny thumbnail sized.
pretty much the size of a USB port.
Yeah. their marketing slogan is like plug and stay. And I'm like, oh yeah, you know, I doubled the capacity of an XPS 13 for 18 months using one of their 128 gigabytes.
That's a good idea.
UltraFit drives. But this one's 256 gigabytes. It's going to cost $149. And if you want something...
It seems like a good price.
Like USB 3.1 support. You know, if you've been thinking like, you know, I just want to put like a couple thousand tunes on a media streamer or a Raspberry Pi box or in your car stereo.
Copying files on and off.
Yeah.
USB flash memory in general is slow as dirt.
Yeah. So this was, I mean, you know, they make nice products. They're also looking at like 1 terabyte USB-C drives. And, and of course, we'll be talking to them about big giant hard drives for arrays. Brooklyn's DeVore Fidelity was there again at CES 2018. I got to hear the Gibbon 10. Which is a very different speaker. It's a very narrow, very tall tower with a driver on the side. It's interesting because it's, you know, their 096 is one of my favorite speakers I've ever heard, which is like a 96 dB efficient. They're claiming like 25 hertz to 31 kilohertz. You know, it's a big, wide panel with two drivers, a 10-inch paper cone and a 1-inch silk dome tweeter. That's the 096. It's like having a big box facing you, except it's incredibly gorgeous. You know,
that's excellent.
It's pretty. They use some unbelievably beautiful laminates on those. The Gibbon X is a tall, narrow speaker with, I want to say, it's a three-way system. They've got like a really tiny 3/4-inch textile dome tweeter, 7-inch mid-range driver, like a pair of 9-inch woofers. And I think one of the 9-inch woofers is radiating out the side of the Gibbon 10. I wish I could have heard more of it because, again, I'm a big fan of the Orangutan series. But, you know, there was more high-end wireless, or I should say high-end wireless, I say high-end vendors there than I had been led to believe there would be. Biodynamic was there with the Aventho Wireless, which I think is probably competition for Sennheiser's HD1. We're going to try to get a pair of those in for review because I want to...
Aventho?
Aventho.
Aventho Wireless.
Aventho Wireless. I can double check.
No. That just sounds elegant.
Well, you know...
And powerful, I'm sure.
I am not particularly elegant or powerful right now, or in general. But Aventho, good-looking wireless headphone. You and I got to sit in Pioneer's demo Tacoma.
You know, that was pretty cool.
It was.
And a moment of silence on the show floor. Crawl into that cab and close the doors. I was very appreciative.
Yeah, it was pretty slick, right? Because it was essentially live. And we had requests from folks in the AVXL audience.
Oh, cool.
To talk about what car audio products we saw there. It was essentially they had their D-series and Z-series speakers wired in parallel, or not in parallel, but basically they had both sets of speakers installed in this Tacoma and a button that would switch between the D-series and the Z-series. So you could do like live A-B testing.
I just fell in love with the Z-series.
I think we both fell in love with the Z-series. That's their more audiophile, flat responding. The D-series is a little more bass heavy, or what they call the American sound.
I didn't feel like the Z's were necessarily lacking in bass, but the overall additional clarity it seemed to provide for the audio that I appreciate that sound quality.
It was impressive.
The Z just kind of lit up my eyes, and the configurability of those speakers too in terms of your options. You know, they had the adjustable tweeters on them in terms of being able to aim those within your within your listening environment, and I don't know how much this was aftermarket versus, I guess it is aftermarket. This was something I would seriously consider upgrading to. It was just a beautiful sound.
It was
out of what was happening in that truck.
I've been shopping for speakers for my truck, and I think I'm going to need to put the Quiet Ride installation in my truck, then put the nice speakers in there. But
it was nice to have both sets of speakers installed in a vehicle where they could A-B it like that for you, just to get an idea. And it wasn't
Get to A-B speaker unless you like buy them and live with them for a month and then buy another set of speakers.
You think about the audition rooms you go to at a store where they might have speakers on the wall. You can select pairs and things like that.
Right,
doing that within an automobile is just tricky.
Yeah.
And we also ran into a couple companies too that deal with being able to calibrate audio within an automobile environment as well. And that just suddenly just brings up a whole side of calibration I hadn't really ever considered before. It's like, you know what? You have to do those things really mm-hmm. nicely. It's like, optimize it for the person in the driver's seat. Optimize it for the person in the passenger seat. So on and so forth. But
a few years ago, I had a lovely conversation with one of the muckety mucks at Audio Control. And I should say, I think he was a CEO or president, but really nice guy, really right. enthusiastic and knew everything about his products. But talking about the DSPs and processors, and they also have processors built into amplifiers now. They do home theater stuff. But it was really amazing to talk about how sophisticated you could get in terms of controlling the audio or timing the speakers.
Right.
Because, you know, if there's 8 feet between you and the front seat and the subwoofer in the back seat, that's, you know, X number of milliseconds and how they were able to control it. It was just, I got to learn more about audio controls, DSPs,
and processors. If you're laying out premium audio within a vehicle and you're doing it yourself, yeah, there are some amazing control options out there just for being able to really fine tune all the characteristics to make it just sound freaking fantastic.
Mm-hmm. More products next week. This is probably half of what we saw on the show.
Seriously. still processing.
Projection screens, more speakers, odd stuff in the corners. My adventure putting Amazon EXA inside of my, 22-year-old diesel truck with...
Did you really?
Yeah, Anchor has the Rove Viva, which Rove is their mobile products brand, but it's essentially a two-port USB car charger that has ALEXA built into it.
Nice.
And it was a nice sort of entry point as I keep experimenting with...
Pair that with a
Google Assistant.
Mobile internet connection, and you are good to go.
It was funny. Getting it to navigate to where I wanted to go required picking up the phone, but just, asking it to play, Rage Against the Machine or Hank Williams Sr. or whatever, was kind of fascinating and probably a sign that I should have started playing around with voice control a year ago, but I don't like speakers sitting in my house listening.
I hooked my roommate up with another ALEXA device and also the Hue light bulbs. And I've never seen someone so happy in my life just to walk around asking for the lights to come on and off and set them to 50%. No, 20%.
38%.
And to that person, it's effectively magic. And it just makes me smile to watch people have that reaction.
One last thought before we leave CES till next week.
Yeah.
How much bad voice control and artificial intelligence was there at CES?
Like I said, I hinted at this, but every manufacturer, at least on the TV side, had to use the word AI. I think that was the mantra for this year.
Yeah.
Without really any indication as to what they're doing with it. Now, I will say on the TV side of things, at least in the highest end for the big manufacturers, they're actually using machine learning to better optimize their video processing in terms of having machines look at things like every sunset ever recorded in cinema and then optimizing that in an HDR way right. to make it look better, as well as things even like noise reduction or upscaling. That's the big one I'm seeing now, is where they'll take a pristine 8K transfer and then degrade it down and say lower resolution with more right. noise, and then tell the computer, it's like, here is what it should have looked like. Can you do things to this in real time to get it there? And you're going to see more and more of that coming forward. But for the most part, if they didn't talk about it much, it was likely just related to voice control.
Right.
Turn it on, turn it off, that sort of thing. In certain cases, that's going to be great. I did have some follow-up stuff from the last episode real quick. We talked about Sonos software. I glossed over it without mentioning probably my favorite thing about it, and that was the music management side of it. One thing I have at home is my entire CD collection archived, organized beautifully in folders, ripped perfectly from the disc collection I own, but there's probably 10,000-15,000 tracks there. One thing I almost immediately appreciated about the Sonos software was its ability to just go through my gigs of music.
Right.
And put it into my mobile device in a way that as fast as I can move my finger through it, there was no lagging or hitching in terms of being able to do music discovery or just enjoy the content I already have. So I kind of glossed over that. Probably my favorite thing about the Sonos software is its ability to manage really large collections like that with literally grace, speed, and ease. And it just made me smile. And then one other quick follow-up, too. We talked about projection, widescreen projection in particular, or right. how to deal with different aspect ratios. And we had mentioned how lens presets on a projector that deal with zoom and focus are much easier than dealing with a manually adjustable lens setup on a typical projector. The thing I forgot to really get into was the fact that most of the people doing this are doing something called constant image height setups, where effectively the height of the screen never changes and all you're effectively doing is changing the width. 235:1 screens are incredibly popular in this realm. For fixed screen designs, folks are literally just putting masking boards on the sides of the screen to do a 16:9. And then when they switch to 235:1 or their widescreen viewing, they'll remove those. Or if you had the motorized masking systems, of course, that'll be pretty nice too. But the key was, is that you never change the height of the projected image. You're simply changing the width. And that does require, ideally, a projector that has those lens presets to make it easier. Otherwise, when you do that switch, you're going up to your projector and manually adjusting zoom and focus and things like that to get it where you want. AVS Forum has a dedicated section to 235:1 projection, constant image height. I was even thinking about a portable screen I had. One of my favorites, the Duet from Epson. They make a portable screen that it's actually 16:9, but it retracts its constant image height.
Oh, really?
But the sides retract into a 4:3 aspect ratio, too, if you ever needed it. In the case of anamorphic lensing, the best case is if the projector itself can pre-distort that widescreen video, that 240, 235:1 video, into a format that takes full advantage of the 16:9 imager in the projector. You don't want the imager in these projectors being wasted on rendering black bars. So if you can pre-distort that image so that that widescreen image, just the image, is taking full advantage of that 16:9 imager within the projector, you're going to get a much better setup. And then the anamorphic lens will apply the image correction to that as it comes out of the projector. It's not as ideal as, say, having a true 4K. The resolution of the projector doesn't matter so much as that you're taking better advantage of the capabilities of the chip in that projector by not rendering the black bars. You're getting, you're dedicating that to additional detail on the screen. I'm going to have to look around and see if anybody actually does like a built-in anamorphic lens on a projector, but I kind of doubt it. Start with the AVS forum and their 235:1 projection forum to get an idea of what people are doing. And like I said, most folks just start with that 235:1 and an appropriate projector that can handle automatically switching between the content types, or at least having the presets where you can just hit a button and you're not constantly fiddling with a projector in terms of its zoom and focus.
Zoom and focus. Oh my goodness. It's funny. I've been looking at IMAX.com/movies, which kind of lists all the movies that are coming up and available in the IMAX format. I've been doing that because I finally saw Dunkirk. One, Christopher Nolan is amazing, which is nothing new. Two, you know, now I really wished I'd sort of, you know, disappeared from the house, abandoned my family, and saw that in the IMAX version while it was still in a local IMAX theater. It is, I don't know.
Visually, I find his movies. I'd be curious to know if he works with the same cinematographer over and over. Who knows? I'll look
a quick
that.
Visit to IMDb.
Yes, we'll, you know, it wouldn't be hard to learn that, but I do appreciate the spectacles and his attention to detail within the cinema process or the filmmaking process.
This was, I mean, such a beautifully detailed film. Every single frame is composed. It's wow.
Another title I need to pick up in 4K UHD.
The color, and I think it would be worth picking up in 4K UHD, but the actors are incredible.
Oh, good.
It's a pretty...
I might turn the sound up.
It's tour de force for no other reason than to just hear Tom Hardy as the Spitfire pilot. There's an amazing cast on that one. And other than that, I've been watching some stuff. Even I am embarrassed to admit I've been watching on Netflix.
I need to get caught up on Black Mirror so I can jump into season 2. Oh, mess with myself. Me personally, this is calibration hell week for me. Just endless displays flying through my tools. In my eyes. And just a shout out to the guys over at Portrait Displays and Calman Software. And I see a new meter in my future, a very expensive piece of hardware that's just mandatory for the work I'm doing, I find out. Or I've so learned. You have to spend good money sometimes to get the tool that's right for the job in terms of just making your life a little easier. And that's something I'll get into that a little bit later. But holy cow, every kind of calibration you could think of this week. Display matching. I had to do a four-way video wall. I did a brand new B7 OLED somebody had in their home. A couple of pro monitors this week. And I'm gearing up for a trip overseas at the end of the month. So
Korea or China?
Korea!
I wonder what you're going to see.
The best Korea.
Oh my goodness!
I can't wait. Actually, I get to work with one of the manufacturers in their display quality group. So
cool.
It'll be interesting.
Well, I'll be rewiring my home theater closet while you're doing that.
I feel you, man. I've been cleaning out the storeroom. I'm finally down to, I think, two TVs and a couple endless I keep finding boxes of cables, and I just need to go through those and just start giving stuff away left and right.
And make sure you properly recycle the remaining cables.
Oh, and of course, I actually needed a HDMI to SDI converter. I realized that none of my devices would output via SDI, which is used on these, a lot of broadcast monitors and pro monitors have SDI right. connections. So thank you, Blackmagic, for creating an affordable yet quality adapter. Make sure you get the right direction, though. You don't want the SDI to HDMI unless you
need
that.
They're not universal.
No, they're not. They're not two-way or however you want to put that. They don't go both ways. This one in particular.
You say it like that.
Specifically, HDMI to SDI output.
Oh, my goodness. More headphones, including the latest models from Sennheiser. I finally got to meet some people from AKM Semiconductor, the DAC manufacturer. I hope to learn more about that. The crew over at Dayton Audio had some new speakers and amps. Audio Technica had blown up like physical models of their $5,000 cartridge, turntable cartridge, the Art 1000, which it was just fun shooting video of because seeing this maxed out version of what's normally tiny and terrifying.
Exactly.
Set up. We'll talk more about those definitive speakers I heard the demos of.
I'm going to ping Samsung too, just to see if there's additional information I can provide at this point regarding what they're doing next, because I'm still in awe of what they're doing with an LCD TV in terms of its ability to compete with OLED. If you thought LCD was dead, this is going to be an interesting year, to say the least.
And a lot of turntables.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of turntables. But we'll talk about that next week, ladies and gentlemen. AVXL.com is the website. If you want to help support the show, we would be just delighted if you would become a patron over at patreon.com/AVXL. If you got a question for us, and we know you do, ask at AVXL.com. This is a very question-light episode.
True.
We'll pick it up next week. I know there's a couple questions.
We owe big thank yous to some of our supporters, too, who just month after month keep us running.
Yeah,
so everybody who's ever contributed, we thank you.
We do.
But there are a few out there that are just like, whoa, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and we've actually, we got to hang out for our patrons of a certain level coming up in the next week or two. We will send out the information on that. In the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, before I hack myself back into oblivion, I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I'm Robert Herron.
We'll catch you next week on AVXL.